Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Reflections in Natural History. I spent some time down in Florida last month and just got back in time to enjoy some of this cruddy Indiana late winter weather. And so it's kind of got me thinking about warmer climes. And on top of that, a conversation that I had not too long ago with a friend of mine regarding some of the great animal sounds and sights of the world kind of combined to get me thinking about an experience that I had many years ago now in the tropical rainforest country of Malaysia. I lived in Malaysia for 3 years back in the mid-70s, and being a biology major, it was certainly the experience of a lifetime. Such an interesting place from a biological perspective. But as I said, a conversation with a friend brought to mind one particular memory of an experience I had there with some of the Southeast Asian fauna, and kind of wanted to share that with you today. The lowland rainforest in peninsular Malaysia is old. It's existed uninterrupted by the glacial advances and retreats experienced by temperate regions like here in Indiana for, some people estimate, 100 million years. And, of course, that's a long time for the uninterrupted forces of natural selection to work their magic. The result has been the evolution of a flora and a fauna that's really just staggering in its diversity. By way of comparison, temperate Indiana, where I live, we have about 50 species of mammals here. In peninsular Malaysia, which covers roughly the same area, there are around 200 species, and about half of these are bats, compared to Indiana's roughly one dozen kinds of bats. Indiana is home to approximately a dozen species of snakes. Malaysia, more like 130 species. Malaysia has nearly 10,000 species of flowering plants. That's about five times as many as Indiana. So for someone who has a professional or avocational leanings toward biology, Malaysia is a virtual paradise. If we take a look at the fauna of Malaysia, revealed to us would be every imaginable adaptation to diet, habitat, and behavior. There are mantids that look like orchids, lizards and snakes that glide, frogs which are identical to dead leaves, and plants which eat animals. However, for sheer grace, unadulterated agility, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a better example of rainforest adaptation than the white-handed gibbon, Hylobates lar, the scientific name. And this is how a tree climbing expedition led me to this conclusion. I was in the Peace Corps in Malaysia, and one of my friends there was a fellow by the name of Richard, who had a PhD in biology and was a great companion in the field. And he was also one of the more eccentric people that I've ever met. He lived, I guess I could call it an ascetic bachelor's existence, in a small bungalow near the school where we taught. If you were to visit his kitchen, you would find one glass, one plate, one set of flatware. His primary in-house diet was beans, and the kitchen shelves were stocked with jars of what appeared to be every variety of edible bean known to man. Richard immersed himself in the culture of Malaysia and even took up the challenge of learning to speak Chinese. I seem to recall it was Mandarin that he tackled. Chinese is a incredibly difficult language to learn, at least from my perspective, because not only are the words strange to our ears, but they must be pronounced with the correct tonal inflection, or their meaning may change entirely. As an example, Richard related to us how he had attempted, while at a party, to ask an attractive Chinese girl to dance. He claimed he had instead inadvertently asked her to remove her underwear. So, as you can see, Richard was pretty entertaining to be around. Richard and I worked together in the biology department at what was then known as the University of Agriculture in Serdang, Malaysia. One day in casual conversation, he mentioned that someone had told him about an observation platform which had been erected in a tree near the University of Malaya's field station. The field station was located in lowland rainforest north of Kuala Lumpur, which is the capital of Malaysia. And this platform was used to observe the forest canopy, and he suggested we try to find it the following weekend. So it sounded like a fine idea to me, and we made plans to do that. So Saturday morning found us at the field station, where we left our car and began to walk in the direction we believed the tree platform to be, based on the description that we had. At that time, sadly, that area was soon to lose its wilderness feel. They were building a new expressway to the east coast, and in fact, we were following a track made by a bulldozer along the survey route for the highway. The directions that Richard had gotten were quite good, and within probably 30 minutes, we arrived at the tree. And what a tree it was. While I do not picture the tree as the one that held the treehouse you played in as a child, try instead to visualize one of the giant trees inhabited by the Elvish folk in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, or by the Na'vi in the movie Avatar. This particular specimen was a red maranti, a member of the genus Shuria, and stood about as tall as a 15-story building. Perhaps in order to envision how this tree stood out in a forest of titans, it might be helpful to understand the structure of a tropical rainforest. The forest in which this Shuria grew is complex, and viewed in cross-section can be divided into five layers. The bottommost, of course, the ground layer, contains the rainforest's scant leaf litter and low-growing herbaceous plants. And then there comes a vegetative layer, which is comprised of slightly taller herbs and small sapling trees. And then a zone 50 to 70 feet above the ground, referred to as the understory. This is a region of small trees and the immature individuals of the larger tree species. Still higher is the canopy layer, which consists of the crowns of very large trees, and the canopy reaches heights of around 100 to 125 feet above the ground. And then some 80 to 90% of the animals of the rainforest actually live in this zone. And finally, projecting here and there from the canopy are the truly massive trees, which form the so-called emergent layer. These trees range in height from 150 to 200 feet above the ground. The lower boles of these giants can be 10 feet in diameter. Add their huge vertical flarings extending from the trunk, and we call these buttresses, and a rainforest emergent may be closer to 30 feet in diameter. The buttresses help to stabilize these huge trees, and because the soil that they grow in is rather thin, fairly poor, which is typical of tropical rainforest. And they also think that the buttresses channel rain runoff and nutrients to the root system. So at any rate, such a tree, such a giant, now stood before Richard and me. It was after we'd recovered from the awe of encountering a tree of that size that we noticed a ridiculously tiny ladder ascending up the side of the tree. On closer inspection, we found the ladder to be about 10 inches wide, made of aluminum. It was secured to the trunk of the tree by means of wire wrapped around large spikes that had been driven into the trunk of the tree. And as we gazed upward then, we located the object of our quest. About 90 feet above us, jutting outward from the Shuria trunk, was the tree platform. So Richard suggested that we go up, and he began to climb. A minute later, he was back on the ground. Seeing as how he had only gotten about 10 feet off the ground, I was puzzled by his rapid return. And Richard said, I don't think we can get up there. I asked why, of course, and he said, the ladder, it just doesn't seem big enough. Why don't you give it a try? Richard asked me. So with that subtle prod to my male ego, I, of course, had to give it a shot. So I stepped on the ladder, and I found why Richard had had second thoughts. Since the ladder was essentially wired to the tree, the rungs were incredibly close to the trunk. It was difficult to get more than one's toes on the steps. So, nevertheless, probably with more bravado than good sense, I continued upward. Richard, seeing that I intended to reach the platform, began climbing behind me. 15 minutes later, we arrived at the platform. It was a nerve-wracking climb, and I still have a downward-looking photo of Richard approaching the platform with a vice-like grip on the ladder and an expression of extreme discomfort on his face. Down below us, the bulldozer track looked like the size of a footpath, and there was one other slight problem. Although the frame of the platform was made of angle iron and appeared to be pretty sturdy, the boards on the platform were a different story. The hot, humid climate had taken a toll on them, and it looked like the floor of the platform could collapse at any moment. You've seen the movies probably where the hero has to cross an incredibly deep chasm over a decrepit rope bridge. Richard and I found that by standing on the metal frame, we were comparatively safe and began to plan our next step. You see, there was another platform at the 120-foot level of the tree. The tree itself soared on upward for many more feet after that. I was once again chosen as the guinea pig and began to climb the ladder to the second platform. But at this point, the relatively small amount of remaining common sense I had kicked in. This last section of ladder is actually affixed to the underside of a massive branch of the tree, which leaned outward away from the trunk. And so I decided at that point the fall of 120 feet would be a really bad way to end the day, and retreated back down to the lower platform. The 90-foot level would have to do. But looking back on it, it's amazing. When we're in our 20s, you just don't think you can get hurt. And probably at this time in my life, I would be a little more cautious about doing something so risky. But at any rate, I got back down to the platform, got my camera out, and began to shoot some pictures of the surrounding canopy. And with my attention fixed on the rainforest instead of the logistics of getting to the platform, I suddenly comprehended the beauty of the position that I held. From this great height, as I gazed over the forest, the grayish-green crowns of other shoria trees could be seen dotting the landscape. Here and there, a splash of vibrant red, yellow, or purple could be seen where a canopy tree was in flower. The whole panorama was composed of what seemed to be every shade of green that could possibly exist. Retreating into the distance was rank after rank of forested mountain slopes. The scene brought to mind the description that F. Spencer Chapman gave as he first appreciated the enormity of the rainforest here. On a World War II reconnaissance mission while waging guerrilla warfare against the Japanese, Chapman had reached a ridgetop from where he could gaze out over the surrounding land. He described the view as magnificent and yet terrifying. He had not realized the frightening immensity of the Malaysian rainforest. From his vantage point, Chapman also saw one forest mountain range after another marching far into the distance. Since Chapman's time, much of Malaysia's rainforest has been converted to rubber and oil palm plantations, of course. However, the view that I was experiencing at that time from the tree platform was unmarred by any signs of human work. I felt the same profound wonder that the colonel had those many long years ago. And then, as I scanned the nearby trees, I saw some movement. White-handed gibbons. They were moving about in another emergent tree 300 yards off to the north of us. Actually, to say they were moving about is a poor description of their activities. This would be like describing the majestic soaring of a condor as merely circling. A small band of primates appeared to be at play, for they passed to and fro, up and down, through the treetop with apparently no clear destination in mind. White-handed gibbons are small apes. They're somewhat less than 2 feet tall and they weigh around 10 pounds. Their collar may be black or buff, but in either case, the hands, feet, and face are white. Their most remarkable features are their exceedingly long arms and fingers. If our arms were proportionally as long, we could touch the floor while standing erect. These forearms are adapted for a special type of locomotion, which we call brachiation, and that is they swing from branch to branch suspended by their long arms. The brachiation of the gibbons I was now watching bore no resemblance to that we humans clumsily attempt on the playground monkey bars. As the gibbons progress from limb to limb, their movements appeared totally effortless. Their arm and hand strength was so great that it was as though, just for them, the law of gravity had been suspended. Their speed of progression around the tree's canopy was breathtaking as they chased after one another. For all the caution they displayed, the performance I was enjoying could have been taking place 3 feet above the ground, not over 150. But gibbons do occasionally fall. One study that was done in Malaysia showed that about 40% of the animals that were examined during the study had evidence of old bone fractures. In their lofty treetop habitat, misjudgment of distance or the selection of a rotting limb can have dire consequences. But the group that I was watching had no such problems and continued their amazingly long arcing launches between distant branches. The bout of play finally ended, and the wonderful experience of the gibbons was brought to a superlative finish as they began to vocalize. Their high-pitched hooting sounds boomed out over the surrounding forest, and this is something what it sounds like. The background music provided by vocalizing gibbons is one of the true delights of the Malaysian rainforest. Lord Medway has described the voice of white-handed gibbons in his book, The Wild Mammals of Malaysia, and he characterized the vocalizations as a series of harmonious hoots and prolonged wails, which gradually rise in pitch as the song proceeds. I guess that's a good technical description, but as you can tell, their words don't really do justice to one of the great sounds of the natural world. How could you hope to capture in words the essence of wildness, the soul of the rainforest, the thrill of listening to a miracle of the creation? The gibbons eventually quieted and began a period of rest, and so I packed away my binoculars and camera, and really could do nothing much more than just shake my head in amazement that I'd been privy to such a spectacular wildlife event. As we prepared to descend back down to the world of humans, the tiny ladder and the dilapidated tree platform didn't seem to be too big a risk. After all, the passage of over 40 years, the clarity with which I continue to recall the incident of the white-handed gibbons has only confirmed this. As always, I thank you for joining me here at Reflections in Natural History. Hope you enjoyed the story, and also hope you'll come back real soon. Thanks.